When your company earns unlimited 2% cash back on all purchases with Capital One, that's serious business. So, Steven at SandCloud got a serious business card, the Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One.
We used our 2% cash back to help build our retail presence.
Savvy, Steven.
And we get big purchasing power, so our business can spend more and earn more.
The Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One. What's in your wallet?
Terms and conditions apply. Find out more at CapitalOne.com/SparkCashPlus.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Chilluminati Podcast, episode 233. As always, I'm one of your hosts, Mike Martin, joined by my beautiful boys in L.A., Jesse and Alex. Welcome, gentlemen. Happy
Hello.
New Year.
Wap, wap, wap.
That's us. We made it.
How was your New Year's, Queen gentlemen? Did you do anything fun and exciting? Tell me about it.
It's fantastic. I went to Vancouver, Canada. Great time.
Did you go
I got to tell
hunting?
Everybody. What's that? I was the Bigfoot. Everybody was hunting for me, man. No, but we went down to a place called Gastown. And this was is perfect for Chilluminati, actually. We were just walking up the street, and Kelly and Amanda went across the street to like check out this pet psychic that was on the business that was a facade that was there, and it had like these really neat like neon lights out front, like a occult eye and like a cat with a moon.
Yeah,
really cool.
There was a few of these back in Rhode Island when I lived in Pawtucket. Yeah.
And then like the door opened, they were taking pictures in front of the lights, and then the door opened and it was like bustling inside. It was like a speakeasy. And inside it was like a 1930s occult, like Cthulhu themed, like French salon style bar and lounge called Pet Psychic.
Okay, that's sick.
It was so tight.
That's so wild. You didn't
we just opened the door and we were like, hello? And they were like, you found us. And like we were like, do you have a table? And they were like, we can squeeze you in if you're out by 8:15. But in fucking Canada, the sun goes down at like 4:30 p.m. So it felt like it was the middle of the night at 6 p.m. And we were in there, and it was awesome. There was like a tiki drink that came in a Cthulhu head with dry ice in it that had like smoke coming out of the eyes.
What the fuck? That sounds fucking sick.
There was cocktails based on the higher arcana of tarot. And every time you ordered one, it came with the card. I ordered the Wheel of Fortune, and the cocktail was roll for your alcohol and roll for your characteristic. And I got like a bold whiskey, and it like came that way. It was like the most stanky old fashioned I've ever had in my life.
That sounds like a lot of fun. I would do that drink simply because of the wheel, even if I don't like drinking anyway. That sounds like a good time.
It was playing the sort of unlicensed horror music that we listened to a lot in Scary Game Squad, like early turn of the century style.
You're all gonna die. Yeah,
like stuff like that. And it was like a combination of like people in cosplay from Gen X who like were waiting for this their whole lives to like finally have a place to like be this in reality, and an old man who was like literally no joke, like, oh, I loved this song when I was younger. Chartreuse, please. Like it was a vibe.
That man haunted by the ghosts of the sea.
Jesse, what about you? What'd you do, dude?
I'm trying to remember what I've done. I'll be honest. I don't.
What did you do for New Year? Anything? Did you just hang out?
No, I didn't do anything. I think I was in bed by 10. I woke up the next day and I like was like, all right, back on the grind. I think I took exactly 48 hours of doing nothing.
Hey, that's pretty good though.
And then I went to bed. Now, I would have gone out, but I then went to bed.
I noticed that was like a big, that was kind of like a vibe. Like, we're on the West Coast, so we have the last New Year's, besides Hawaii, which shout outs to the homies in Hawaii. But like, in the continental United States, we had the latest. And everybody's like, my mom and dad were like, we're doing Mountain Time New Year so we can go to bed early. Or like, we're doing New York New Year. We're watching the New York one so we can go to bed early. And it's like, that's not New Year's. You're just going to bed at 9 p.m. the night before New Year's. I don't know.
Yeah. No, I didn't care. I went and I got like a good New Year's Eve kind of like food outage. That's right.
Food outage. Balto had to come bring you some fucking stew.
I needed help. I needed those dogs to come save me.
Yeah.
And then I like went home and was like, what if instead of staying up, I like slept, bro. And so I may have had an edible or three and then went to bed and it was great.
An edible or three will put you to bed for sure.
Yeah. It was lovely. And then I woke up the next day and I was like, ooh, I guess I'll go play a video game or something. And it was great.
Woke up a leprechaun.
Saints preserve us. Yeah, I didn't do jack for New Year. New Year, it's weird. I'll do stuff if people want to do stuff. It's just like my birthday. It's like every holiday. I don't care about any of them.
But if someone wants to do stuff, I'll do it.
But like, it doesn't affect me.
I like New Year's Day. It is probably because it is my mom's actual birthday, which happy birthday, mom. But also, it is like the ultimate Sunday for some reason. I don't know why.
Oh, absolutely.
It's not really a holiday, but everybody's like, by the way, we don't open on New Year's Day. We're just not doing anything on that day. That's our jammy day. So you guys understand. Sure.
I remember like the decade of working in restaurants, working New Year's Day was basically taking a day off, but in the restaurant because there was really nobody coming in ever until way later.
Like we never really slapped like a real tradition on that day. Like California, we got the Rose Parade, and I think people watch that all over the world. But like there's not really a New Year's Day deal, but we all just kind of like do puzzles. Yeah, I don't know. It's tough.
Yeah, I just smoked some weed and I started playing through Dragon's Dogma again in preparation for the sequel next month. So
into free, dude.
And that game still absolutely holds the fuck up. It still got, you know, the combat in that game is just extremely great. It's tight. It's fun.
I'm excited. I'm excited for that entire sequel. I have a list on my desktop right now of every game coming out to the end of March that I want to play, and it's a lot, and I'm a little worried.
Which is if you haven't, everybody go check out Geek Enders podcast, Jesse's new podcast with Dodger, where you can hear him talk about video games and
I do love the games
Dodger,
but I don't love the holidays Dodger.
You know, she asked to come back and then trying to schedule her is like impossible. She'll be back at some point. She lives in England.
Stop having kids. That's my advice.
Don't have children.
And everybody's favorite, Crendor, reached out to me the other day wanting to come back on the show too. So he'll be back.
He's just Crendor.
Yeah, he's exactly just bored. He's just bored.
Come over here, Crendor.
What is that? Is it because I went Dodger?
Message Math is back, Crendor.
Who are you?
You can always message me on patreon.com/illuminatipod though.
I'm so glad that you segued to that because it is such a good website, not just for reaching out to us if you want to be a guest host as a mutual, but it's also a great place to go if you want to support the show that we put on, because that's the point of that website. And honestly, if you do want to contact us, you already know how. We're mutuals. You probably have a phone number. So, you know.
I would hope so.
But in general, everybody else should go to patreon.com/chillmanitypod because separately, it's a good website. And if you go there, not only does it keep our lights on, but you get neat things in return, like a digital version of a PBS tote bag. Like what you say? Ad-free episodes, mini-sodes, rotten popcorn episodes, bespoke art, all kinds of shit. All kinds of shit that we put on there. You know, great stuff. And if you pay us $10,000, Jesse will sell his soul to you for 1 month's time.
It's not worth much, but
hey, $10,000 is $10,000, baby. Yeah.
Yeah.
That'll pay a good chunk of
people. Yeah, there's got to be at least one, like, Coke
Time for irresponsible alive, decisions, right? Rich people.
Yeah, there's like one Coke brother
there's
alive.
There's at least one Coke brother that could pay me to say some crazy shit.
Come here, you Coke brother.
Come here. Are we hunting the Warriors? Is that what's happening right now?
The Warriors was one of those movies that I watched, and I am one of those. It was so boring. I was so bored. Yeah,
you're like that kid who's like black and white.
It just didn't. I don't know. It was just boring. The Warriors. I maybe watched it when I was too young. I was like 17, 18.
When I worked at a video store for 7 years, I heard a lot of opinions from normie bormies about what they thought of movies, and the worst like take. Like the most lazy worst take that anybody can have about a movie as a cashier from Blockbuster Video is saying that the movie is fucking slow. Get the fuck out of here. What do you mean it's slow?
It's paced in a way that you don't like, and that's okay.
Yeah,
I don't think you could dig it.
I didn't dig
it. They asked, can you dig it? You were like, I don't think so.
I played the Rockstar game, though. That was pretty good.
Yeah, the game's great. The game's fire.
Game was good. I also watched like Thank You for Smoking randomly, and I didn't like that either.
Are we just doing updates on random movies that you've watched at certain points?
We just got to talk. Welcome to the new year where the podcast has totally changed into a what are we doing in our daily lives podcast. Now, it's episode 233, boys, and it's a brand new year. And I'm excited for this topic because I have been wanting to cover and talk about covering this topic for a few years now. It just ended up being, Alex, you can probably relate to this. It's one of those topics that there's no good, like, solid source. It's a lot of different sources with varying different stories on it. All come together.
That is why those listicles exist. Ticles.
Yeah.
That's why those listicles exist.
Well, this is one of those.
.com/Patreon.
Thank you to today's sponsor, HelloFresh. With HelloFresh, you know it by now. You're getting farm fresh, pre-portioned ingredients and seasonal recipes delivered directly to your doorstep. You can skip trips to the grocery store and count on HelloFresh to make home cooking fun, easy, and most importantly, affordable. That's why it's America's number one meal kit, duh. With the holidays officially over and resolutions in full swing, whether your resolution is to save money or eat better or stress less, HelloFresh is here to help you do all three. Say hello to your most delicious year yet. You like that? That's the punniest line in the world. With fresh ingredients and chef-crafted recipes at a price you'll like, delivered right to your door. Each HelloFresh box is packed with farm-fresh ingredients, and everything arrives pre-portioned right to your doorstep for less hassle and less wasted food. And if you're like me and are always kind of busy and don't, like, have a ton of time to just crank out a 45-minute meal, HelloFresh has you covered there, too. All you gotta go to is HelloFresh's lineup of quick and easy meals, including their 15-minute recipes, designed to help minimize mealtime. It's delicious, and it's fast, and it's almost exclusively what I've been doing lately. This sounds good to you and it's something you want to at least give it a go, head to HelloFresh.com/chillfree and use code chillfree for free breakfast for life, which is my favorite meal of all time. One breakfast item per box while subscriptions is active. That's free breakfast for life at HelloFresh.com/chillfree with code chillfree. Don't forget, they're very important. Those two things are very, very important. Thank you again to HelloFresh for sponsoring today's episode, America's number one meal kit. It's one of those examples, one of those conspiracies, if you will, that is kind of muddled in. There's a few strands of truth in there that we can pull on and we'll talk about, but it's hard to really pinpoint if most of this is true. It likely is not. That in mind, we're going to be talking about the Philadelphia experiment today.
Yay! What a big one!
That is a big. It's one that's been coming for a while. It's again, it's messy. There's really no good source other than the one book that was published by the guy who claims that this was a thing. As I always like to ask, though, you boys both know Philadelphia experiment?
Yeah, this is the this is like the most losty mystery. This is like the most Dharma Initiative shit. It's like dudes getting teleported into bulkheads and squirming around and mis-executed teleportation experiments. Yeah, right?
Strong Not Penny's Boat vibes.
Something Montauk, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. Something Nikola Tesla.
Correct,
something,
correct.
Something, blah, blah, blah.
And the thing with Nikola Tesla and Von Neumann, which is who you're referring to, you know, two of them, depending on who you talk to, they may or may not have been involved. But for the sake of today's story and the sake of what seems to be the general consensus, they will be involved. So as we go through this, just understand this is my attempt at pulling a bunch of things together to create a cohesive narrative about something that is messy at best and absolutely fictional at worst, which is likely where it sits. But again, there are little nuggets of like actuality that kind of run through this, but we'll talk about it.
You got Denver airported is what happened here. That's, you know, it happens, man.
It's not the first time, you know, we've been in this now.
You were like, this is like a classic topic. Everybody always wants us to talk about this. I bet this is going to be so juicy. And then you found out the reality is that like, we're going to cover this entire mystery in one episode and everybody's going to think it's fake by the end.
You are 110% correct, and this started like 3 weeks ago. And I'm like, this is taking so much longer than I thought it was going to go. Welcome. So basically, with the Philadelphia experiment, the story goes that in the fall of 1943, in the bustling naval shipyards of Philadelphia, extraordinary scientific discoveries happened. The Eldridge becomes, which is the ship's name, becomes enveloped in a strange green fog, and voila, it simply vanishes before your eyes. Only to reappear moments later, and then another attempt months after that, that completely changed our understanding of physics and reality. To understand, this ship is 300 feet long and a 1,200-ton ship. This thing is fucking huge.
This is like a big metal American warship, like a big...
And we're in the middle of World War II right now, fighting, you know, multiple fronts. This is like a big boy who's very important.
This just goes to show you, when it comes down to which of these fucking things are the ones that everybody loves to trade and talk about and get excited about, it's just all about showmanship. It's all about the coolness of the fucking setting. This is already, this is riveting compared to half the stories we talk about in terms of like cinematic spectacle. Like, what are we talking about here?
There's a movie based on this already.
Yeah.
It's called The Philadelphia Experiment. I think it's from 1984. I have not seen it. It just popped up in my research constantly. Have you seen, speaking of, have you seen that? You guys are more movie buffs than I am.
I know that it exists, but I have not watched it.
Okay. It actually plays a role. The movie plays
like
a role in the story. The actual movie plays a role in this.
Hold on to that question,
Jesse. I can't answer you right now.
I know what the show is. I'm just going to.
So we're going to go ahead and navigate through the fog of conspiracy theories, eyewitness accounts, supposed classified information. Was it a military marvel, an elaborate hoax, something entirely different? We'll figure it out as we go through the most tantalizing and mysterious stuff surrounding the Philadelphia experiment. In the U.S., we're going to start in the 1930s. And in the United States in the 1930s, it was a vibrant place of colliding contradictions. While people were suffering going through the throes of the Great Depression, they were also, at the flip side, we're looking at people dancing to the rise of upbeat rhythms and swinging jazz at that time too. So people are, you know, internally kind of sad, but externally a lot of the art and the music is keep people moving in a happy mood. And it was in this decade of weird hope and hardship that whispers supposedly began to stir in the scientific community, whispers about a theory that would change everything. At the heart of these whispers and murmurs was none other than Albert Einstein himself, the father of relativity and the dude with the craziest hair in the whole wide world. Einstein at this point was already a legend for unraveling the mysteries of the universe, rumored to be working on something even more groundbreaking. And this is an actual theory. It's simply called the unified field theory. And this elusive theory, very enigmatic, kind of compare it to Schrodinger's box, promised to marry gravity with electromagnetism, potentially unlocking the secrets of the cosmos.
I don't want to be weird right now, but I do want to just highlight the similarity that this has to that sort of all one energy, gravity manipulation, electromagnetic alien UFO technology.
I'm going to take that and say it's part of the episode, Alex. We'll get to that.
Yeah, all right.
This is tied into the UFO world, maybe even more so than just beyond the similarities in technology. There is that kind of feel of like weird, like everything's kind of related. And I'm going to try here to give you like what this theory is in a way that hopefully like I got it right and maybe made sense. But basically, so Einstein, as far as we know, spent the latter part of his career working on this unified field theory, aiming ideally to unify at least gravity and electromagnetism into a single framework. The idea is like, we know we can like get electricity from magnets or magnetism, but so he's trying to basically put an umbrella and say everything is related to everything. Like it's all one thing.
Sure.
But despite Einstein's efforts, as far as we know, he was never able to successfully do so. He never was able to develop a complete and working unified field theory. Again, or so they'd have you believe. The search for a unified field theory, or a quote unquote theory of everything, as a lot of people other people call it, it continues to today be a major goal in physics. Modern approaches to this problem include string theory and loop quantum gravity. But as of now, a fully successful unification of all fundamental forces hasn't been done yet. We haven't gotten there. The quest for such a theory is one of the more ambitious and challenging things to do in the field of theoretical physics. So this unified field of everything sits at the core of the Philadelphia experiment as a whole. And while the rest of the world was learning about the jitterbug, Einstein was allegedly deep in thought, his brainstorms perhaps as electric as the swing bands of the era. Because all I can think about when you do swing dancing is like swinging the women from one hand to another. And that's all I can think
Is that how you see that?
Yeah, swinging the women?
Yeah, they like do a little spin and their dress, you know, and swing on the other side.
Swinging the women.
Swinging the women from one hand to another.
Swinging the women.
That's all I think about it. I don't know what to tell you. The unified field theory remained shrouded in mystery for him, as it was never published or peer-reviewed. But in the hush-hush corners of supposed scientific gossip, it was said that this theory could do the impossible. Bend light through the manipulation of electromagnetic fields to be able to render something invisible to the naked eye. So cloaking technology, essentially. This ability to like, and I feel like that idea has been used in movies many times.
Bending light?
Yeah, bending light as a way to cloak the thing in front of
us. I don't even really understand how you bend light, to be honest.
Well, that's why the theory hasn't really come to fruition yet.
Yeah, it's hard for me to conceive exactly of what it is to bend light.
Well, we know we can like bend light just through like a glass of water, for instance, right? Like that's an example of light kind of being bent and distorted.
Right, but like other light just doesn't get bent, right? Like,
yeah,
like, I mean, you know what I mean? Like, would it make you invisible to bend some of the light? I don't know.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you could control the way the light is bending, I imagine, and which way it's refracting, possibly.
Yeah,
but,
I don't know. The real deal is this is like me just like stoner brain thinking about this, but like, I don't really understand. I always think about people saying bending light, and I never really understand what bending light means.
If you're of age in an illegal state, honestly, this is a great episode to just light one up, enjoy, throw on something, and just go for a fun fucking ride.
And if you're a physicist, this is a great time to head over to reddit.com/Chilluminati pod or Chilluminati, what is it? r/Chilluminati pod, yeah. And illuminate me on what theoretically bending light could possibly mean.
That'd be great. I would love you to explain how we got it all wrong.
in a simple way.
Yeah.
That's all.
Eli five me. That's all
I'm interested. I'm interested.
In a simple way.
Now we're not
smart.
Forward.
I'm not that smart.
You're very smart, Alex. Don't like anybody else.
I'm smart in other ways, but not about physics. Physics, I don't have a lot of intelligence about.
All right. Well, we're going to fast forward now out of the 1930s and into the 1940s, the early 1940s specifically. We're now in an era where the world has turned a very dark corner with the onset and the thriving World War II. In the midst of this global turmoil, the U.S. Navy, it said, was pursuing a war strategy ripped straight from the pages of a science fiction novel. And this, other than being known as the Philadelphia Project, had a codename Project Rainbow. And this ultra-secret endeavor aimed to apply the principles of Einstein's theoretical musings to something startlingly practical and, if successful, frighteningly powerful. Cloaking a naval ship, not just from radars, but from just your very eyes, disappearing in front of you. And by mid-1942, this project allegedly began to take shape in earnest. A man by the name of Dr. Franklin Reno, a name that would later be whispered in the same breath as the experiment, was rumored to have been brought in to turn this theory into reality. Reno's existence and role are as much a part of the mystery of the experiment itself, with little concrete evidence to confirm his part in any of the unfolding drama. And just to give you a quick list of names of people who were supposedly heavily involved in this. Obviously, Dr. Franklin Reno, we're looking at Albert Einstein. We've also got Nikola Tesla, who was supposedly involved in this. Tesla was, if you didn't know, famed for his pioneering work in electricity and electromagnetism, sometimes said to have been involved in the initial phases of this experiment. According to some, because he was dead by the time this experiment was kind of happening. I think he had died by then. According to some versions of the story, Tesla was given the responsibility of applying his expertise in electromagnetism to achieve the goal of rendering the USS Eldridge invisible. However, Tesla died in January of 1943, and there are no reliable historical records linking to him to this supposed Philadelphia experiment. We also have involved John von Neumann, a renowned mathematician and physicist, Hungarian. He is also sometimes cited as a participant in the project, And this suggests that von Neumann continued the work after Tesla's death, applying his own expertise in quantum mechanics and computer science. Von Neumann's involvement is often mentioned in relation to the supposed bizarre effects on the crew members, like mental disorientation, the physical embeddedness of people within the ship itself, as these were thought to be the results of tampering with quantum realities. Just, again, to kind of wrap that in there. And then two other people that are going to be important to the story overall, a man by the name of Morris K. Jessup. This guy was an astronomer and self-proclaimed ufologist. Jessup is an important figure in the spread of the Philadelphia experiment story, and we'll get to why later. But after receiving correspondence from a man by the name of Carlos Allende, he became one of the first to publicize the alleged events in his book, The Case for the UFO, which we will be referring to later. Then there is Carlos Miguel Allende. He's a somewhat kind of an enigmatic figure. Allende also we'll get to that in a minute. He's got another name he goes by. Is the person that's the most responsible for publicizing the Philadelphia experiment. He claimed to have been a witness to the experiment while serving on the merchant ship SS Andrew Furuseth. His letters to author Morris K. Jessup, the guy we just talked about, in the 1950s is what brought this story to the public eye. And this guy's name actually isn't Carlos Miguel Allende. His name is Carl Allen.
Allende?
He's a white Carl Allen. He created this fictional name for himself when he was writing the whole stuff involving the Philadelphia experiment is Carlos Miguel Allende.
And he's just my dad.
The reason he ended up coming forward and you know, making it known it was him is hilarious. And we'll talk about it at the end when we're kind of wrapping this up.
It's just dad walking into a Mexican restaurant. Let me get a dos enchiladas, por favor.
Agua con gas.
Everybody out here in Texas too. As 1942 eventually kind of gave way to 1943, we had a set stage for something potentially extraordinary. In the Philadelphia Naval Shipyard, the USS Eldridge, a cannon-class destroyer escort, awaited its role in what would become one of the most tantalizing tales of military lore. The ship, like a character out of a Houdini act, was being prepared for a performance that would baffle and bewilder, a vanishing act on an unprecedented scale. Now remember, we're right smack dab in the middle of World War II at this point, and fighting a war on multiple fronts. Having the ability and technology to turn something invisible in front of your very eyes would have been groundbreaking and war-changing. And if this is all true, supposedly, FDR, recognizing how important this would be, just made the decision that this project was best used for the Navy, which is why it's the USS Eldridge that's doing this. It was the president's decision saying the Navy was just the most important part of this war at the moment. So let's continue on now to January of 1943 and set the scene for the supposed events leading up to the infamous Philadelphia experiment. Now, remember, there's a lot of shit that's going to happen. So just try and follow. If you have any questions, I will happily fucking clarify. So in the throes of World War II, where apparently some folks in the Navy thought, let's get an actual invisible shield. We begin in the early months. The Navy, in a stroke of genius or madness, depending on your viewpoint, decides to dabble in kind of like mystical scientific reality bending experiments. The USS Eldridge with the number DE-173 is the one chosen for this grand experiment. And if you ever wonder why, it's maybe nobody knows what the specific reason this specific ship was chosen for. It could just be random. It could have been for a reason. We do not know. According to legend, the ship is then rigged with some serious hardware. We're talking generators, Tesla coils, and other tech stuff that sounds straight out of like a freaking Star Trek convention. The goal of all this technology is to create an electromagnetic field so powerful on the ship that it would render the ship invisible to enemy radars and people's eyes, to just warp with electromagnetism, supposedly.
So like radar cloaking.
Yeah, radar, but also in front of your eyes.
Cloaking. Eyes, you're right. And both. Eyes.
Yep.
How would that work, though?
Magnets, dude. How do magnets work? Magnets.
That's exactly what I'm saying.
But like, what scientists would be like, you know what? Electromagnetism, if we do it enough, you just won't be able to see it. Like, that's not even how that works.
It's the, yeah, they're trying to apply the unified field theory, and I don't, I don't know how they're doing it. Technology is what
like my brain. Like I'm no scientist who digs to the center of the earth to save the planet from a not spinning core, but I'm pretty sure the entire plot of that movie is like, yeah, no, the entire planet's covered with an electromagnetic field. And it prevents us
from like, bends the light around you. The electromagnetic field bends the light around the ship, causing it to become invisible.
Okay. All right.
Thank you, Alex. That's the attitude we need here.
I'm picturing a Klingon warbird. Just
yes. Yeah. Right, yeah. Look at yeah. Well, not. I mean, Klingon. Yeah, but it also
it never works out well for them.
Or though. Romulan warbird.
Romulan.
They always end up getting their gas detected. Yeah. Like the tailpipe, and then they get blown up every time.
It's true. Well, we'll see if this really works for them. I don't know. Maybe it will. If
Picard
maybe it
was there, he would have seen through this whole thing.
I just want to apologize. Are we talking Picard from TNG though, or Picard from Picard? Because if Picard from Picard,
same guy.
He ain't gonna see shit.
What do you mean, same guy?
He's busy dealing with the androids of androids.
He is an android now, but a flesh android that ages.
Shit. Apologies to Klingons and Romulans. I didn't mean to mistake you for each other.
Space racist.
In fairness, neither of you exist.
I mean, that is fair.
You're going to get an angrily worded letter from the Klingon Empire, my friend.
And I will not be able to read it, and I will not look it up.
They will be like, Kupla, bro. Kupla.
Kupla. So as we move through the winter of 1943 into the spring and summer, the thing is now fully decked out, and rumors are beginning to swirl around the naval yard like crazy. Whispers of weird experiments, mysterious unknown scientists, and Einstein's secret recipes for bending reality. The sailors look at the Eldridge with a mix of curiosity and maybe even relief that they're not part of that ship's
crew. How much time is this we talking about?
So when we talked about them decking the ship out was the beginning of January 1943. Now we're looking at about July is when the first test, I believe, happens.
How close is this to like the general public?
They're decking it out in the general public, but the general public doesn't know what it's being decked out for, which is why the rumors begin. They see scientists.
But the green gas and all that happens?
No, that doesn't happen yet. That happened. They're not going to do it like in the freaking shore. They're going to take the boat out.
Out.
Okay. And then do it.
All right.
So the brains behind this operation are said to be, like I said, some of the most crazy, brilliant scientists of that time. And you trying to turn Einstein's unified field theory into reality. And so we finally move into now October. So October 1943, January to October 1st, this rolls around and it's time for the first attempt. The stage is set. The Eldridge is ready, totally decked out in weird tech. And the Navy's top brass are probably rubbing their hands together in excited anticipation. The experiment begins with a simple flick of a switch after they take the boat out. We imagine a flick of a switch, but as a moment happens, you hear the crackle of electricity, a weird, bizarre scene unfolds in front of you. The Eldridge is then engulfed in a weird greenish fog. Then, as if by magic or questionable science, it simply vanishes for a few moments, only to reappear right where it was a couple seconds later. Witnesses that got to see this reportedly saw the ship materialize out of thin air but beyond a few of the crew members feeling a little nauseous afterward, nothing of note seemed to cause any issues. In essence, a success, if a shortly lived one, as it only was a couple seconds, but it happened. They did it. They made it work. So they decided to bring the ship back on shore and spend the next few months putting more technology on the ship. They put in more Tesla coils and other technology that bends electromagnetism and prepared ideally for another attempt a few months later that would work.
Wait, so was there any science in the like number or were they just like more?
More, Jesse. More.
They were like, well, we got it for a few seconds. So if we just put more Tesla coils on it,
we're going to be gone
for like a minute, bro.
It's just not, you know, maybe they burned the files. We just don't have them. We only have eyewitness accounts, supposedly.
I would just love to know what there's got to be some sort of science here where they were just like, all right, we'll put two more on, see what happens. And then we'll do three. Or it is some guy like, all of them, gentlemen, all of them. Like, that seems crazy to me. No wonder people was in bulkheads and stuff, according to the story.
Well, now they're going to actually attempt this again. In July.
It's like a Godzilla movie type guy pushing them, right? Like,
That's what I imagined. Like, just do it.
And also, I want to point out that we also mentioned, if you remember, the Greenstone Part 3, Part 1.
Yeah. I do not, no.
Which was like a underwhelming UFO story that Jesse didn't like very much. Do you remember that?
I don't remember any of that, no.
I don't know if Jesse liked any of the Greenstone very much.
I think he has a fondness for it. That he
can't,
you know, I like to think that somewhere in there. Anyway, there's the story is about they're driving and they have like a UFO encounter, and what appears around them as the UFO-y part of the encounter occurs is like a rolling, like, you know,
yes, I remember this,
6 foot high green fog. And if you're thinking about it from the point of view of like why an alien would do that, and you know now that that might be residue from electromagnetism bending light to create invisibility from outside, maybe there's something there. Just drawing parallels.
Then you're going to need to help me explain this, because a few months later, after they decked it out with more technology, it was time once again to give the big old red button another push and see what happened. But instead of green fog appearing and creeping in, this time the ship simply vanished in a bright flash of blue light. Just gone.
They went too far. They did too much.
Like nothing there, or like,
yep, invisible. Like nothing there. Because this time
it's gone.
The ship didn't reappear, at least not where it originally vanished from. Instead, it appeared 400 miles away in Norfolk, Virginia. It just fucking absolutely just moved 400 miles. And so, kind of like antibiotics, instead of discovering what they were intending to discover, they accidentally discovered teleportation instead.
It appeared on land?
No, near it, in the water.
Oh, shit. Okay.
Success? Maybe? Question mark. As it teleported there, it would only sit in the water out there for a few moments before in another flash of blue light, just as mysteriously as it appeared in Norfolk, the Eldridge zips back to Philadelphia, where it originally departed from. The ship reemerges in another wondrous flash of blue light, but it's not quite the same. Something is askew, not just with the ship itself, but also the crew, who are beginning to experience their own personal hells the moment they return back to Philadelphia. But there we have the two experiments. The journey from January to October and October to July, giving those experiments and what ended up happening. But the side effects of the Philadelphia experiment are perhaps why this story is known as well as it is. It's where the line between science fiction and really fucking bad, terrible day gets blurred. And let's take a look at some of the post-experiment world of the USS Eldridge and its crew that sounds horrifying. And first, we'll just start with the ship. What ended up happening to the ship after this? Well, there was what was kind of like, I kind of called just teleportation tarnish. The USS Eldridge, after its alleged jaunt to Norfolk and back, wasn't just your average ship anymore. It supposedly traveled through space and maybe time, and it ended up coming back with a weird, like, rust and wear and tear that it didn't have departing. Then the ship itself became a legend, an unwitting celebrity in naval circles and conspiracy theories. It kind of turned into a weird version of like naval Bigfoot. Supposedly, every once in a while, somebody can see the Eldridge kind of pop into existence and then disappear again, even though that doesn't make any sense unless it was, I mean, times
where,
whatever. Then you got the magnetism stuff with the post experiment. The Eldridge supposedly had residual magnetic fields. Compasses would go haywire near it. The electronic equipment would just act up. It's basically like it was just frying a ton of different electronics that are just for what it went through. Then supposedly the Eldridge was also said to be shrouded in an eerie glow afterward, adding to its bizarre aura as like a weird ghost ship in a way. And just
all the
like,
time?
Yeah, just kind of like glowed all the time, very dully.
Anybody take a picture?
No, like temperature changes as far as I know.
I mean, a picture, a photograph?
Oh, no. Why would you have that? It's the 40s. It would just be black and white anyway.
It glowed?
But it was glowing.
The whole ship was glowing?
There's a super secret, top secret, super project.
It was glowing and rusted? That certainly is
in dry
a
dock?
Thing that I would love
in
to
In Norfolk,
see.
Virginia? Or in Philadelphia?
No, Philadelphia, after it returned.
That's a big... There's a lot of people in that city.
I mean, hey, man, I don't know what to tell you. I only know what the facts are, and I'm telling you the facts.
All right.
Facts? Fair enough. Hold on. Purported facts.
Facts are facts, man. I can't argue with the facts.
Yeah, exactly. You can't argue with facts.
Facts are facts.
Can't argue with the facts, baby.
A few other things, the electrical equipment for then on, like just around the ship, just behave erratically. Even after like the braking aspect of it passed, there was always this like electronic equipment didn't always operate quite right in there. And then you've got the magnetic disturbances, as I said earlier, but also it was supposedly like would draw in metal objects, like an actual magnet. The ship started like pulling in metallic objects to the ship. It had like almost its own gravitational pull.
Like a car
pull.
Or like somebody's
Jesus
piece. No, like
we're talking
piece.
Smaller things, like small things. And it was not like it was stuck permanently. You could pick it up and pull it off the ship. It just had a weird like magnetic
like a property. Yeah, okay.
Property to it. Yeah. But the real horror wasn't really what happened to the ship. It was what happened supposedly to the crew, or a long list of things that happened to this poor fucking crew. If this, you know, actually happened. So let's talk a few of them. First, you got your basic stuff. Things like your physical ailments. You're talking nausea, intense nausea, vertigo, headaches, a condition known as quote unquote molecular distortion, where the body's very structure felt misaligned or out of sync. Then some people were supposedly developed a weird relationship with electromagnetic fields. They would suffer shocks when touching metal objects, or electronic devices would malfunction or behave erratically in their presence. So they just were like the anti-technology supervillain. Anything near them breaks. They couldn't use it. Then you have the weirder things that we'll talk about. But last we have psychological trauma, you know, mental toll was taken on the crew. Many of those involved were said to have suffered severe psychological disturbances, including acute anxiety, debilitating paranoia and hallucinations. The trauma was reportedly so intense that some were said to have been institutionalized, while others supposedly vanished and were quietly discharged under mysterious circumstances.
Do we have any stories of their accounts of what happened?
Yes, we will get to that.
Thank God. All right, that's what I care about.
That's what I want to know. What happened when they looked? Give me, bring this to life for me, please.
Yeah, I want to know what, like, when they went through the looking glass, what happened?
Oh, dude, you are not ready for the actual first.
I am so ready. So that's all I want.
A narration of a man whose leg is still stuck in a bulkhead.
Yeah.
Then you have the invisibility after effects for some sailors. Some of them allegedly continue to experience bouts of invisibility long after the experiment. They would just vanish from people's sight. They were random, uncontrollable, leading to terrifying moments where individuals would simply phase out of visible existence, sometimes just partially, sometimes entirely.
No pictures of this.
Huh?
No pictures of this, though.
They phase out of existence. Yeah, can you
pick up a fucking cup?
No, that takes too long. No.
It's vampire rules, dude.
Get dressed.
Yeah. Get them.
Yeah.
All right. Sorry.
No,
all
right. You can't do that. Then you got the people
who
respond.
Do the clothes become invisible when you touch them?
Then you have the other people who instead of respond. You?
How does that work?
When you're dressed, what happens? Like if your clothes weren't on the Philadelphia, on the Eldridge.
Well, so the way I imagine it, if we're going to take this question seriously, is if you're radiating your own electromagnetic field, you're bending light around you accidentally. So you'd be bending light around the clothing as well.
Disappear.
And so if you were holding something, even if it's a cup, I imagine that would vanish as well.
All right. Well, the science checks out.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, checks out. They got us.
If you're not one of the ones spontaneously be going invisible, maybe you're one of the ones that got spontaneous phasing. This was this phenomenon where crew members would suddenly and inexplicably phase through solid objects.
Like Shadow Cat.
Like my Shadow Cat, exactly.
No, Shadow Cat from the X-Men.
Oh, or my Shadow Ghost
same
Cat.
Guy, yeah, house. Same guy, yeah, basically. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, Kitty Pryde.
They were unable to control it.
She had a dragon.
That's true. She did.
They were unable to control it, and they were harrowing accounts of sailors who got stuck in their own walls and floors at home, and like horribly, horribly, like fucking injured and shit, like just absolutely displacing themselves.
That's what the fuck is that?
But the ones who walked out with physical, psychological, or like random phasing like problems are the ones that were fucking lucky. Because then you had the people who, after its return to Philadelphia, were physically melded on a molecular level to the ship itself. One of the most grotesque and frequently cited side effects was the supposed fusion of sailors to the ship's bulkhead. Like, imagine crew members becoming unintentionally part of its structure. They were supposedly screaming like in utter pain and horror. The bodies were completely fused with the steel, arms emerging from bulkheads, faces embedded in the deck, a surreal and like kind of ghastly human ship amalgamation.
Take a picture of this, man. This is fucked up.
No pictures were taken.
This is unbelievable. I don't think you
should, man.
No.
Plausible deniability. We can't like let those guys suffer.
You're right. Let's get out of here. USA.
If you need to understand why they didn't do this, why they didn't take photos, just go watch the Star Trek episode where the A plot is Data having sex and the B plot is people getting stuck in the bulkheads. Remember that. That happened. They cared more about Data getting banged than people like stuck in the ship. So obviously, yeah,
honestly, you might that's be right,
a one to one translation.
Robot was getting fucked somewhere.
Let me remind you, technology kind of fried in the presence of the ship, so it was hard to get pictures of anything because the camera would break.
Oh, duh.
Did anyone draw anything?
Maybe.
Did they cut one of the guys out of the bulkhead and like sort of wheel the bulkhead down the street with
not
him
that we're
it?
Aware?
He's like,
of
I got a story to tell.
Did anybody ever like go to the newspaper like my daddy is a wall?
Then we have people who were burning from the inside. I got to keep going.
From the inside? Holy shit.
So according to some accounts, they were basically sailors would feel something like internal burning, and they learned that their very cells were overheating and undergoing some form of weird radiation poisoning that led to extreme discomfort in some extremely rare cases. Spontaneous combustion, baby.
So they got so supercharged, they just blew up.
Instead of going Super Saiyan God, they just exploded.
Any record of that in any newspaper? These guys blowing up?
There are records of people who have spontaneous combustions.
I mean, I know that there are records of a few people who have spontaneously combusted, have any of them coincidentally been crew members of the Eldritch?
Maybe.
It is not known.
If you don't have proof that they weren't part of the Eldritch, they could have been.
Hey, facts are facts.
Exactly. Thank you. Facts are facts. Then you have the people whose psychological trauma was so bad, their entire sense of self disintegrated. They had no grip on reality, unable to discern between past and present. Hallucinations were so intense, and they experienced severe disassociation from themselves. And they were so shattered their psyche had become shattered from this. Then you had phantom sensations on limbs for some people. Some of the most bizarre effects or reports of phantom sensations on limbs. Sailors who were merged with the ship's hull would feel as if their trapped limbs were still free, experiencing a haunting disconnection between their physical and sensory realities. And then there's people who just temporally looped, expanding on the time displacement aspect. Some accounts suggest that crew members got caught in a short, repetitive time loop. Imagine experiencing the same moment, almost like a Groundhog Day scenario, over and over and over and over. Unable to break free of that moment.
So you're sitting next to this guy. What are we looking at here?
And I just like a skipping record, you know? He's stuck in that one place.
Wait, what?
Yep, like that.
Wait, hold on, but like, what does that mean?
That sounded like Emperor Palpatine electrocuting Luke Skywalker on the deck of the Death Star 2.
Bye. Yeah. Wait, hold on. So it's not that. Wait, so are they experiencing a time frame over and over again, or is it
like
they're just trapped in one second?
Like,
I don't know.
Okay,
it's never specified.
I mean, at least that's honest. It's not specified.
I don't know.
It is not known.
Can you read it again? What does it say?
Yeah, I got to scroll back up. Yeah. So they were. Some accounts suggest that crew members got caught in short, repetitive time loops. So imagine experiencing the same moment over and over, unable to break free from an endless temporal cycle, a phenomenon that not only disorients, but also traps the individual in a slice of time. So sounds like they get stuck in a moment of time. They themselves are there. So maybe nobody else is being able to see it.
Okay, maybe they're just sitting there having breakfast. And then all of a sudden, like I'm like one halfway through a spoonful of chili. And then I'm like, oh shit, I'm back. Oh my God, thank God I was stuck eating that fucking chili for 15 years.
Oh God. Oh, that'd be awful. Yeah, that's terrible.
Would you recognize it though? That's the thing.
I mean,
if you're trapped in that moment in time, would you recognize it? In fact, If you were trapped in a moment in time right now, if this podcast went on forever, would we recognize it?
No, we wouldn't. I've thought that thought many a time. Like,
have you? Did I just blow my own mind with your mind?
I kind of. It's the idea of like time is a flat circle. Maybe we've just done this infinitely and we'd never known.
The same episode over and over again. I still haven't learned anything. Over and over.
This is it. This is where we live in eternity, dude. It's a spiral. And then there were other people who literally just became like frozen, like almost like statue still. They would just be frozen, stuck mid-sentence, mid-movement, and just stuck there, apparently aware of their situation and their surroundings, but unable to move.
That's until their body like released fake themselves. Weed.
Is that what happens when you smoke fake weed?
I remember there used to be like you'd become like a zombie, like you just smoke and then you like are out there on the street just like
what is fake weed? Can you explain to what makes the fake weed fake?
Once upon a time in a land long past, you could not get weed legally from the state of California. And in those times, people would smoke fake weed that was unregulated and unlicensed.
What does that mean?
It was like a weed substitute. It was like, you know, impossible like salvia? Weed. Yeah, no, it wasn't salvia, but it was like some kind of chemical shit. It was like, you know, meatless meat. It was like not weed, but it had the effects of weed. But it was unregulated, and people would just get like whacked out on it and like just march around on the street, freeze on the sidewalk and shit. It was fucked up. Don't smoke that shit. Just wait till you can get weed somewhere legally, please.
Sounds terrible. I don't like it at all.
Like, you don't have to. You don't even have to do weed. Y'all, you don't have to. You can just like hang with your friends and get high on life, dude. It's chill. You won't turn into a zombie that way unless your friend's a zombie, in which case you're a zombie.
So those are the two full experiments, the attempts that we know of. I believe at that point they decided this isn't working. We got to stop this because they fucked up a ton of different people's lives in multiple different ways. And any known further experiments are not really documented if they happened, obviously, at all. We have a few eyewitness accounts, which we're going to get to in a moment. But also we talked about how this is tied directly in a way to the UFO stuff. And that's what we're going to kind of jump into now. The primary connection between the Philadelphia experiment and UFOs can be traced back to the man I mentioned earlier, the author Morris K. Jessup. Jessup, an astronomer and early UFO researcher, wrote the book The Case for the UFO in 1955, which discussed unidentified flying objects and their potential propulsion systems. After the publication of this book, Jessup received correspondence from a man by the name of Carlos Miguel Allende, who claimed to have witnessed the Philadelphia experiment and provided a detailed account of the event. Allende's letters to Jessup introduced the notion that the technology supposedly tested in the Philadelphia experiment, like invisibility and teleportation, could be related to the advanced propulsion systems of UFOs. This idea suggests that either this is all from Carlos Allende, aka Carl Allen,
aka the Zodiac Killer, what's his name? Arthur Lee Allen?
This idea suggested that either extraterrestrials had shared such technology with humans, or that humans had independently developed technology similar to that used by UFOs. The connection was then further solidified when Jessup was contacted, and this is true, by the Office of Naval Research, the ONR, about a copy of The Case of the UFO that had been annotated by unknown individuals and left for the ONR, this guy to find. These annotations contained references to the Philadelphia experiment and further linked it to alien technologies and UFOs. Again, it's annotated by people that are unknown. Like he reaches out to the author of this book to see if he knows maybe who annotated it and whatnot, and he has no idea. This annotated version became known as the Varo edition, V-A-R-O. You can actually get a copy of, like, I think it's the original Varo edition or one of the OG Varo editions from back then for $7,500. I looked, it's expensive. This Varo edition, this book, is kind of like a key document in a lot of people's UFO conspiracy theories, intertwining the Philadelphia experiment with like extraterrestrial lore. But those people are utterly wrong, and the book is not to be trusted as it is presented. And we're going to talk about why as we continue. Over the years, as the story of the Philadelphia experiment grew and morphed within the UFO conspiracy theory communities, it became part of a larger narrative that includes government cover-ups, advanced technology, and alien encounters. This narrative suggests that the experiment was either an attempt to harness alien tech or that it inadvertently attracted the attention of extraterrestrials. Again, this is also a time where UFOs are starting to become much more widespread, and in a few years, the Roswell crash would happen. In the twisting saga of this Philadelphia's nonsense, the ONR enters the picture in a chapter that's as intriguing as it is kind of unusual, involving a peculiar version of the book by Morris K. Jessup. So this is where Carlos Miguel Allende kind of comes in and becomes a bigger player through all of this.
How long is all this after the initial event?
This is in 1957. This is happening. And the experiment took place in 1943. So over a decade later, like 13 years after the supposed...
Is when stuff finally started to come out, is what you're saying?
Yeah, this is where it supposedly... Like the Philadelphia experiment was, I think, maybe like a rumor or maybe just like a story. It's here in 1957 with this book that we get a lot of what we know today, and where like a solid quote unquote,
like the crystallization of it. Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of like we have a physical version of it with the notes. You can read the memes notes.
Is yeah. Matured, ready for harvest.
So just for timeline's sake.
Yeah. Yeah. Please.
For timeline's sake, because you were talking about Roswell, it would be like
after Roswell.
This event took place before Roswell, but the information publicly put out was after Roswell. Actually, like a decade after Roswell.
A decade almost after Roswell. You are correct. Yes. Yep.
Okay. All right.
Dead on. So Jessup's book, The Case for the UFO, which just delved into the mysteries of UFOs on their own and their possible propulsions for technologies. It's kind of a book where he's just trying to like figure out what technology would work to explain the way these UFOs are moving, because we can't explain it. And while seemingly unrelated to the naval experiments and Project Philadelphia, Philadelphia experiment rather, it would soon become a pivotal link in the tale of the Philadelphia experiment. And that's where Carlos Miguel Allende, also known as Carl M. Allen, steps in, who was a mysterious figure who had claimed to have witnessed the bizarre events of the Philadelphia experiment firsthand. Allende reached out to Jessup with a series of letters, like I mentioned earlier, detailing this account of the experiment. He described how the USS Eldridge was rendered invisible, teleported, suggested connections to ET technology, and Jessup's interest was piqued, but the story was still far, far, far from the public eye. And that's when the plot thickened in 1957, when the ONR received a strange package. It was a copy of Jessup's book, but this wasn't just a normal edition of the book. The book had been extensively annotated by an unknown individual or individuals. These annotations weren't mere musings, but they were detailed discussions on the Philadelphia experiment, linking it to alien tech and expanding on the ideas Jessup had explored in his book that were simply referring to UFOs. This annotated volume, like I said, became known as the Varro edition, named after the Varro manufacturing company that later printed copies of this text, and was a bizarre amalgam of Jessup's original work and these mysterious external insights. The ONR's involvement was primarily due to their interest in these annotations, which were unusual in their depth and scope. The annotations discussed not only the Philadelphia experiment in detail, but also a range of esoteric topics, including anti-gravity and UFOs. So the ONR, intrigued by this unsolicited and cryptic manuscript dropped at the doorstep, decided to contact the author of the book, Jessup. And this contact between the ONR and Jessup lent an air of legitimacy, at least at first, to the at least official interest in this stuff, and added that kind of legitimacy to the Philadelphia experiment. And it suggested that perhaps there was more to this tale than mere conspiracy theory and science fiction. Maybe there's something at the root of this that's true. The ONR's role in this narrative, while largely that of a curious observer, helped cement the Philadelphia experiment in the annals of paranormal and unexplained phenomenon. Thus, the ONR, through its incidental connection to Jessup and the enigmatic annotated edition of his book, became part of the story as a whole. The thing is, when Jessup was called in to talk with the ONR about his book, he was handed the book that was annotated by these mysterious people. And Jessup, immediately upon grabbing the book and seeing it, recognized the handwriting of the book. because he had been getting letters from Carlos M. Allende
for years.
And it was the exact same handwriting.
This guy is like the page master of this.
Yeah. So it's all Allende. Allende's been like sending letters off.
Baby.
To,
yeah.
Yeah. He, and this Jessup had no idea. And this, so, you know, and these notes were originally kind of referred to as annotations by Mr. A, Mr. B, and Jemmy, G-E-M-I. But he realized, because the thing is with Carlos, if you look at his handwriting, and you can go look at it, the man capitalizes randomly. He misspells a lot of things. It's really hard to tell, like, if this is one person or if it could be multiple people. But the thing is, Jessup recognized it instantly and realized that these notations were from Allende. However, hoping to push the process of having the government investigate UFOs on an actual real scale, he never originally admitted to him that he knew where those annotations came from. And Jessup himself went along with the lie for a bit that he didn't know who these annotations were from. Let's talk a little bit about what happened in terms of having Carlos or Carl come forward and reveal who he actually is. Because like I said, the book with annotations started getting printed, known as the Varro edition, by the manufacturing group Varro. And it was all like, you know, just copied of his annotations just on the book. And somebody was making money. And Carlos Allende wasn't making any of it because he hadn't come forward to claim that it was him who wrote it. And when the book started selling and doing well and making like, you know, making it into like UFO meetings and stuff, the dude was like, I need to make this money. So he came forward and was like, I wrote it. It's not, you know, it's not a mysterious man. It's me. I'm Carl Allen, baby, not Carlos M. Allende. And also it wasn't anonymous. I did it. But shortly after he admitted to doing it, he saw how quick the books were popping off because people believed them. So he quickly retracted.
He was like, JK.
He'd be like, just kidding. I didn't do the annotations. It's all real. It's like, you know, go buy the books. I just wanted credit. It's not me. Well, I imagining making a deal in the back end with the book people to get paid for it. All while Jessup himself started struggling heavily. He wasn't making a lot of money. It wasn't like, and he was, in 1959, basically, only 2 years after this book was released, he ended up killed himself. He locked himself in a car, you know, sealed the windows, fed carbon monoxide into his window, and he committed suicide. And the reason, so that's taking on surface level, at surface value, people immediately tied that to the Philadelphia experiment and leaking all these things and the government, quote unquote, suicided Jessup. And it became another like spoke in the wheel that supported the Philadelphia experiment as an actual thing. When in reality, Jessup, the astronomer and early UFO researcher, had other factors that might have played into his decision.
This just never would have happened if there was internet, basically.
Maybe. He was facing significant professional challenges because he was such a UFO guy. And despite his early promise as an astronomer, he struggled to gain academic recognition and was not affiliated with any major institution. His focus on UFOs was considered fringe science and marginalized him in the scientific community pretty heavily. And he faced financial difficulties because of that, which added to his stress. And he also became increasingly disillusioned with the UFO community, especially after learning this mysterious annotations were from somebody he knew. He was frustrated by what he saw as a lack of serious scientific inquiry, which is why he went along with the lie, hoping that they would put money into it if they believed that these people writing annotations were maybe like secret people with information. But he also had just personal issues in his life, which may have contributed to his distress. He had gone through a divorce. There were many reports of him experiencing depression. It wasn't like a sudden thing, like the conspiracy people would like to have you believe. It was very much, you know, he was a very depressed individual, and it just kind of sucks that happened that way. Regardless, though, his book on all this stuff invariably were now tied to the Philadelphia experiment. So let's talk now about an eyewitness account. J- Jesse's been wanting this. So let's talk about the best eyewitness account of this that we have. And
Before we do this, before we jump into eyewitness accounts, what you've just said is that all of the stuff from the 50s is bullshit.
That's only if you have a closed third
eye. If your third eye is glued shut.
I just want to be
You gotta be like Doctor Strange opening his time stone, but for your third eye.
A lot of what was the truth was actually just dude making it up.
Maybe, because this eyewitness isn't Carl Allen.
Facts, baby.
This is a different eyewitness.
Okay? No, I'm here for this. This is the stuff I'm here for.
Now let's talk about who this guy is. So it's important to note that this ended up being a little bit later than 1957. While the factors mentioned above provide some context to like what happened with Jessup, by the way, like his state of mind and time of death, I just want to make sure you like understand the man was having troubles. He didn't fucking kill himself because the Philadelphia experiment jumped out there. Right. So now we're going to fast forward from 1957 to the 1980s, boys. We're now in the 80s. Things are great. The economy feels good, even though it's on a downward trajectory that would reach its actual like manifestation in the late 90s. Everybody's having a great time. It's a good time in the 80s. And so comes a man by the name of Al Bielek.
Why does that sound familiar to me?
Listen to the story. Maybe it'll ring a bell.
All right.
Long after the Philadelphia experiment supposedly had taken place in 1943, long after the book that talked about UFOs and had annotations about the Philadelphia experiment in 1957, in the 1980s, a man by the name of Al Bielek stepped into the limelight to claim his slice of fame. He came forward with an astonishing claim. Not only had he personally been involved and seen in the Philadelphia experiment, but he also had an incredibly story that linked it to other secretive government projects and firsthand account of time travel experiments.
My man just went for it.
He just threw
the football as hard and as far as he could. God bless him.
I mean, yeah, that's really, this guy was like, you know what? This is important. I need to talk about this. Now, you might be wondering, how come he only came through in the 1980s? Well, as I said earlier, the movie played a pretty big role in this, right? He was watching the 1984 film, The Philadelphia Experiment, and the movie, in a bizarre way, unlocked forgotten memories in Al Bielek's mind. As he was watching the movie, he had revelation after revelation, memory after memory of the hell that he went through serving aboard the USS Eldridge and the horrifying things that happened to him from it happening. It stirred his memory, boys, because the movie...
It woke him up?
Yeah, the movie woke him up, really. It was like, oh, shit, he remembered.
He was like, wait, I saw that. That actually happened to me.
Yes. And his brother.
All right.
His brother had the worst outcome. We'll talk about it. So according to Bielek,
all right.
His involvement in the Philadelphia experiment, also known as Project Rainbow, was as a crew member of the USS Eldridge. He claimed that the objective of the project was to render the ship invisible to radar using technology derived from the theoretical work of Nikola Tesla and others. Now, it's important to know Bielek was lucky enough to be sat down by Einstein himself and be taught personally his theories and why he believed them to be real and true. Isn't that pretty cool?
I'm here for it.
He got to sit down and have lunch with Einstein multiple times and was taught all of Einstein's stuff.
And then he saw that movie and he was like,
I remember that happened.
Oh, yeah. I had lunch with Einstein. That's right.
He also met Nikola Tesla and before he died and von Neumann.
Whoa.
Bielek didn't just describe the experiments in technical terms. He narrated a story that was nothing short of insane science fiction. He alleged that during the experiment, something went dramatically wrong, and instead of simple radar invisibility, the USS Eldridge supposedly achieved physical invisibility, phasing in and out of existence in itself. This, Bielek claimed, resulted in catastrophic consequences for the crew, with some of the men becoming fused to ship structures, stuff we've already heard of. Bielek's story then takes an even more fantastical turn as he links the Philadelphia experiment to another alleged secret project by the government, known as the Montauk Project. Do you know the Montauk Project?
I know that it has to do with Nikola Tesla, and that it
the
was
Montauk
like,
Project is what Stranger Things is based on.
Yeah. Okay. But it does
like the underground.
I know Russian the tower. Experiment. I know there's like a tower that was like on top of a building. Or yeah,
we will do a Montauk Project episode.
What's the one with the hats and the cats? And they kept trying to like
the cat and hat.
Remember, like, he kept trying to like.
Yeah.
Teleport the hats.
Yeah, and Nikola Tesla was like
I know what you're doing and I'm here for it. Please continue. Please. I see it in your eyes. This is a goof. This is a good goof. Don't let me down. He's laughing too hard.
Changes. All right. That's all I got.
That is for movie fans out there. No spoilers. I'm not going to spoil that.
Do you know what movie that is, Mathis?
No,
it's The Prestige.
Have you ever seen it? No,
you've never seen the. God, I want to watch The Prestige with
of
you.
Of all the movies that you're surprised I haven't seen, The Prestige is one.
Dude, that's wait so till
you
up
see
your
it.
Alley.
Wait till you see it. Let's hang out and watch it. That's a good one.
I mean, I'm down. When I visit next time, we'll watch something. According to Bylik, when the USS Eldridge reappeared after vanishing from the bright blue light, but not in Norfolk, Virginia, somewhere in between, he and his brother Duncan Cameron immediately jumped off the ship before it vanished again and teleported to, we assume, Virginia and then back to Philadelphia like originally. Except he wasn't in 1943 any longer. Not only had the ship teleported, it had time hopped. And now they were in the year 1983. But not 1983 as we know it. A branched timeline of sorts, if we use MCU terminology here. And it was a darker timeline where some sort of catastrophic event had happened. San Francisco was leveled and TVs were flat.
I'm sorry, what?
TVs were flat.
What do you mean TVs were flat?
He woke up in a hospital at one point and he saw that TVs were flat.
Like he woke up to flat screen televisions?
Yep, in 1983.
No.
So San Francisco was destroyed, but we got flat screen televisions like 2 decades earlier.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Yep.
It's like and, the butterfly but
everything
effect?
Was destroyed. Yeah.
Cool.
So he predicted flat screen TVs. Maybe he did go to the future. Huh? TVs Evidence. Are flat. Evidence.
TVs are flat, man.
I mean, TVs are flat. That's crazy. That's how you know he was in the future.
I'm
Come on,
blow your
that's
mind,
all
dude.
I got.
TVs are flat, bro.
But he wasn't going to be stuck here forever, boys. Al would find a way out.
How long was he stuck there?
Well, okay.
Are you really stuck when TVs are flat?
I mean, true, right? Aren't you in a good place? So, here's the thing. Duncan and Al both jumped off, member brothers. They suffered different issues. They both were lost their lock in time, their place in the time stream. And, For Bylik, that meant kind of feeling sick. He really wasn't able to, he was disoriented and he eventually passed out and found his way. And when he woke up, he was in a hospital, which is when he realized he was in like a wasted a cityscape and, you know, TVs were flat. His brother, on the other hand.
So he went from the East Coast to the West Coast as well?
Yeah, teleported, time jumped, everything.
Okay.
But you know what happened to his brother, Duncan? He didn't have such like light side effects. He had time displacement to the point of every hour was a full year of aging for him. And he died.
And then he woke up and it had only been one day. He lived a whole life.
But don't worry, because the Montauk Project was also happening here as well. And they met up and met up with Al Bylik and brought him in. He began to work with the Montauk Project to get him back to his appropriate time. But the Montauk Project also was going to fix the error of his brother's dying. See, the Montauk Project took a couple of people that were working on the project and sent them back in time to 1950, where their job was to find their father and tell them he needs to have another child, because he already had his two kids, his son and his brother, Duncan, and he needed to have another child. They convinced him to do so. He banged out another child, and the Montauk Project took the soul of his dead brother and placed the soul of his dead brother in the now newborn child. Therefore,
that just looks
ensuring
like the same brother.
Duncan gets to have a life through a different baby. But remember, it's kind of like a different timeline. And
this
says
has lost his soul. What
this
was the
has
process?
Lost all credibility for me.
I don't know what they used. I don't know what kind of technology they need to scoop
a soul. This is like a lifetime This is like a lifetime time travel movie plot.
Yeah, I don't know why they didn't just go back in time and like push Duncan off the ship before the ship teleported the first time. Like, but they went back and convinced
his dad. My expectations, Mathis, were we were about to hear about like a guy who was in the military and he was on the ship when it all went down. And like people around him are getting like he's seeing crazy stuff and like time and space is coming before him. And he's like, I don't know what's going on. And I had to like fight and struggle to like come back whole. It was the craziest shit I've ever seen. And what you gave us was like Land of the Lost. Like some dude just like I
was like the time traveler's wife.
I saw the soul of my brother.
It's like 11/22/63.
Well, there are other accounts that what happened to his brother wasn't that he aged ever for every hour and died. Instead, Duncan got lost in time and kept time slipping like Loki in season 2. He just kept slipping to different parts of time and they had to like time hunt him and find him and take him and pull him out of time and put him back in his right full time in 1943. So you can choose which one do you want? You get to pick which one of your reality.
They both suck. Here's the problem. They both suck. They're both
I wish you outlandish. Could see this show because you could see the look of like sheer confusion that just washed across me and Jesse like in a shockwave in two parts of town at the same time.
Like all I wanted was the cool version of this where it's like the movie version where a dude is we're seeing all the crazy stuff happen and he's like he made it out and he's fine but like oh my god you should have seen what was going on. That's what I wanted. Instead you were like yes.
He's still in game today.
Yeah. Like the version that isn't the insane made up version.
It's not insane and made up. The people who went back and put the soul back in, they were called time engineers.
Okay. All right.
Cool. That's a real role.
So cool. Yep.
Cool.
Eventually, Biliquid, with the assistance of Project Montauk, would make his way back to his appropriate time on the original timeline, because all good vacations have to come to an end, I guess. And he re-enters the 20th century, memory wiped, ready to live a normal and happy life until the fateful evening where he viewed the 1984 film, The Philadelphia Project. And it all came back. It all came back. You can't permanently wipe a man's memory. It'll come back.
Have we ever had an episode about like how we really need to deal with the mental health issues of this country? And like we need to just be better as a people.
Americans?
Treat people better.
You mean we're like like a global disgrace kind of vibe?
Yeah. Kind of like we really let these people down.
The obvious vibes, villains, you know? Of reality. Yeah. Is that what you're talking about?
I feel like just something. It's almost every episode just reminds me a little bit more. I'm like, you know, I feel like we let these people down in some way, but you know, all right.
Yeah.
Sure. Time travel.
Education.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, if we're able to teleport a ship, we're just
his
like.
His brother's soul was put in another body that not an identical twin, just another body that many years later happened to look like the exact same
exactly
mother.
Like him.
Exactly. Like, because that's how genetics works. Exactly like him.
It's a plug and play scenario, like Legos.
Yeah. It's time is like Legos. Doesn't really matter as long as they
it would have made more sense if he was like, I went to the future and then and I took my dead brother and cloned him or put him in one of those, like, what does the crazy people on the internet talk about? Med beds? One of those? We should do an episode on med beds, by the way. That's loony stuff. Like, put him in one of the sarcophaguses from Stargate and he was fine. They had one of those in the future. Like, he could have just said that and everyone would be like, yeah, all right, that makes way more sense than we extracted his soul. And then went to the past, convinced my dad to bang out another kid.
Which he banged out. Quick snap.
And then that kid, who we grew up with, because in the timeline, they would have grown up with him.
Yep.
But then they replaced the kids. So that is a brother they knew that they got rid of to then bring the other brother back to life. That's insane.
But let me say this. Would somebody who's lying come up with a lie so crazy when they could come up with something so simple as a med bed?
Touche. Touche.
Honestly, there you go. You can't really go back on that. According to Bilek, he was involved with multiple future experiments in the future of 1983, none of which make any sense. But eventually, through those experiments, they were able to return him back to 1943, where he was taken from and given back to his life through government manipulation. That's how his memory was wiped, he says. It was government manipulation to repress said memories. The only other like quote-unquote firsthand witness we have is a man who actually did serve on the USS Eldridge.
This is what I'm here for.
And his firsthand event is interesting in that there isn't one. He says that if any of this is true, they may have been testing new radar cloaking technology on the ship in some fashion. But beyond that, he did not confirm any of the bizarre, weird shit that happened. Only that they maybe were testing some sort of experimental radar cloaking device on the ship that he wasn't fully aware of. And that's the story of the Philadelphia experiment. Hey, that's it. That's where it ends. That's literally all of it. That's it. That's all there is on this. And could you believe there's a huge number of people out there who still think this is true? Why?
It's crazy because it's like, when are you guys going to do the Philadelphia experiment? When are we going to finally find out? And that's clearly somebody who's read like a one sentence synopsis of the Philadelphia experiment.
Yeah.
Because the moment you look at, I've tried to do this episode several times myself.
It's impossible.
It's just impossible. Good on you for finding all this shit, because damn, this did not happen.
Now it took, and I left out a lot, like, cause there's a lot of information that just simply contradicts with one another. This is my best kind of like put together timeline of the best and like most quote unquote credible things out there that at least come from some person.
And, you know, we're doing our diligence. We're like paying homage to this legend. We're doing the service of actually investigating it and finding, after doing that, that it's more myth than truth, right? So what's wrong with that?
I want to check out that old ass book, The Case of the UFO. Even with it's interesting to look at the annotations that were in there anyway, because it's just fascinating what he was writing down. But that's it. The Philadelphia experiment is done. We don't ever have to come back. There's nothing else to come back to. It was a fun time. It's a wild little story that has.
I just need to add this because I had
to look
up
what you're
going to
add, because I'm curious what I cut.
Well, so I wanted to look up an idea of just. So what do people think? Because you were saying, you know, like this is, it was hard to find information on. It was hard to do, write an article about. And I was like, there's got to be a solid wiki. The wiki is not solid.
No, the wiki is not solid at all. It sucks.
But it does link to a 1980 article from Fate. I assume Fate magazine in 1980.
I imagine.
And in it, it literally says, and I just wanted to just read this last bit because it is so good. Because it goes to what you guys are saying. Various book writers who have tried to get more information on Carl Allen found his responses elusive, or they couldn't find him at all. One reporter from Allen's hometown of New Kensington, Pennsylvania, interviewed his family and was handed a pile of documents and books, all scribbled with Allen's annotations. They described Allen as a fantastic mind, but also a drifter and master leg puller.
You never want to be referred to as a drifter
or a master leg puller.
I mean, it depends on one thing.
Even the people doing book research on this were just like, there's nothing here.
No.
Which says a lot about this. Is like, if anything, this goes to,
it's like American
what people
folklore
are willing to believe and completely overlook. Because it just sounds cool.
It's like Johnny Appleseed vibes. It's like, you know, fucking Babe the Big Blue Ox shit. It's not, there's nothing. Like, what we're saying about just being like, who took a picture of this? Like, how come nobody spoke about this? The ship was glowing and nobody took a picture. That alone is enough. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yep. Agreed. It's fascinating. And like you said, the minute you start to try to dig deeper, it just becomes a sea of messy fucking nonsense. Yeah. It's so hard to just like trace a timeline where
how the story is on a surface level very cool. Like, honestly, I was like, oh, I want to hear what's going on the ship. Like, it makes for a good story and a horror story as well, which people love.
100.
And so you combine it all together and it's like sci-fi and weird and who knows. It is the exact same vibe as, except it, that's terrifying. But it's the exact same vibe as watching like any sort of like sci-fi space Event Horizon-y style movie where you're just like, what the hell am I watching? That's what I imagine that story is. And the minute you dig beneath the surface, you're like, oh, there's nothing exciting here. It's all rather depressing that people really buy into this existing, because it really doesn't.
No, it doesn't. I mean, the guy came forward and said it was me who did it and then retracted it as quickly as he fucking could because he was like, oh, money. Like, this is one of the few situations where you can actually see somebody who is like, money, I'll change what I'm doing specifically because they're selling books with my shit in it. Yeah, it's wild. So I'm glad it was done. I'm super fun topic. It's been one on the radar for a while. Knock that sucker out. And that's it for the episode. So thank you guys so much for joining us this week. We'll be back next week with a brand new one, but we're going to go off to go do a mini-sode for patreon.com/IlluminatiPod.
Oh,
video
yeah.
version of the $20 tier, audio version of the
$15. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, and I'm going to leave you a little tidbit. We might be doing a little teaser for some merch. A new Mothman run might be in the works for the plushies.
Is this the teaser
of
now?
Of Mothman.
There'll be some changes to him, his design. We'll see. We might see some color changes for fun. But we might have a new run of the Mothman plush because people have been asking for it a lot. So we're going to try and get that going for you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you guys so much. And we'll see you next week. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Anyway, me and my wife were sitting outside indulging on our porch one night, enjoying ourselves. I needed to go to the bathroom, so I stepped back inside, and after a few moments, I hear my wife go, "Holy shit, get out here." So I quickly dash back outside, and she's looking up at the sky in awe. I look up too, and there's a perfect line of dozen lights traveling across the sky.